Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players, uncover their stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, stick around. You're in the right place. The Be Fulfilled Journal helps you be more honest with yourself and with others and be more open to handling things you've avoided dealing with for years. It's a 12-week online and journal program that helps you identify and eliminate things you do that are causing you stress and live in more gratitude and joy. It was actually developed by a long-term friend of mine who got sober in 2008, and he's put together a great deal just for my listeners. You get the 300-page hardcover journal and access to the 12-week video program online, plus free shipping, plus membership in a private Facebook support group with others going through the program, plus a 5-day mini course showing you how to let go of stuff that's draining your energy, plus a 30-day 100% money-back guarantee. To start your journey and get all the bonuses, go to befulfilledjournal.com/ELG. That's befulfilledjournal.com/ELG. Hey, everybody, it's Craig Garber. Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar. And we are with a multi-talented, super cool dude, Walter Eno, who is an LA-based stage and studio multi-instrumentalist. This guy is like a child prodigy on top of that, which we'll get into. He was most recently out as the lead guitar player for the Eagles of Death Metal. He spent 2011 to 2017 as a member of the multi-platinum Grammy Award-winning band Survivor, playing keyboards, guitars, and singing background vocals. He currently tours as the keyboardist with the legendary band The Babies and is music director for A Night of Symphony Rock, A Night of Symphony Metal, and Rewind, which are national orchestral rock shows featuring major rock players. You can see him as a rotating member of the award-winning Las Vegas and Branson show called Raiding the Rock Vault. He's also guitarist for an all-star tribute to Rush called A Farewell to Kings. This is like the first paragraph, and I'm exhausted by how much work you do, Ray. But wait, there's more. He's also the house keyboardist and guitarist for the world-famous Ultimate Jam Night at the legendary Whiskey A Go-Go in Hollywood every Tuesday night. He's either playing either keys, guitar, or bass with Baked, a monthly music and comedy show that originated at the world-famous Baked Potato with loads of top players like Mike Keneally, who was recently on this show. He's also was the main keyboardist for the Russian rock ballet Heart of Storm, a global touring show with loads of top players, including some I've had as guests here on Everyone Loves Guitar, like Rudy Sarzo. Walter was born and raised in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. At 6, he started training as a classical pianist. At 8, he did a run of a regional tour of The King and I as an actor with Yul Brynner himself. I got to ask you, what was he like?
I was such a young kid, but he was intimidating.
Yeah.
He was very sweet at times, but he was also, he, from what I remember, he was very, very strict, no pictures. And, he was definitely an intimidating man, like very, very intimidating.
I could see
That's the only word I can remember that I could use to describe him right now. Cause he was, just very strong, you know.
Yeah, he looked strong. He spoke. Walter, put cell phone away. No fucking selfies. At 9, he started an elementary school band where he played saxophone throughout his school career. At 14, he studied piano under the – this is Walter, not Yul Brynner, by the way. At 14, he studied piano under the head of music at Carnegie Mellon University. At 14, playing Mozart, Beethoven, and Rachmaninoff, which led him to performances at churches and halls all over Pennsylvania as well as St. Petersburg, Russia. That's wild. I do 2 gigs, Pennsylvania and fucking Russia. That's it, man. I'm not going to New York. I'm not going to California. Fuck North Carolina. It's Pennsylvania and Russia. He also bought a guitar at this time. From there, he played with a number of groups, one of which was the Daily Entertainment at Kennywood Park, which is a legendary amusement park outside of Pittsburgh, where he played 6 shows a day, playing multiple instruments and multiple genres of music. More bands formed and dissolved, which led him to Seventh House, which ended up signing a record deal with Blackbird Atlantic in 99. After moving to New York City and all the tours and attempted radio success, Walter then moved back to Pittsburgh to start his own project called Strangeway. They released two full-length CDs and played shows all over the world. At the same time, he spent his free time, producing other regional bands. From that time, he got hired to play and tour with numerous artists such as Survivor, Denny Lane, who of course was Paul McCartney's guitarist with Wings, Jack Russell's Great White, LA Guns, Liz Berlin from Rusted Root, and many other artists. You can watch Walter playing in and around the LA area on a weekly basis. He plays keys, guitar, bass in weekly bar band gigs alongside LA and Orange County's finest musicians. He also runs his own studio called Secret Asian Man Studios, where he produces. If you weren't Asian and you said that, you'd like be arrested or something. You know that, right?
Well, technically, I'm Pacific Islander because I'm Filipino, but whatever, it works.
Yeah, but you know, Americans are like that's Asian. You know, no one's Secret Asian Man Studios, where he produces many artists of different styles. And tracks instruments for many artists. He also plays his original rock trio, The Strange West. And we'll talk about Secret Asian Man Studios and learn about Secret Asian Man himself. Walter, thanks for your time, man. Appreciate you coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, man.
And, man, can I say congratulations to you? You're expecting to be a dad in June.
Yes, June 3rd is a little girl's. I hope she's mine.
I'm sure it's all good, man. Now, congratulations. It's a lot of fun. It's a big change. So that being said, I'm on the tail end of that and I'm really happy. So
there you go. I'll take any advice I can get.
Yeah, man. Hey, you started training as a classical pianist at age 6 and you really had a lot of other very significant musical milestones as a kid. Was there like someone in your family who spotted your talent or who shepherded you through this? Because I would imagine, you know, that'd be something.
Yeah, I came from, there was always music in my house growing up. And, you know, my mom and dad were just big music fans. They loved Elvis. They loved the Beatles. My grandmother was a piano teacher in the Philippines. And then she was also a principal for the school that she was teaching at back in the Philippines. So there was always music. So my mother was a really good piano player. My dad could sing. Then I had two older brothers. So that was a big influence on me. My two older brothers would, you know, when I was younger, I would have to sit there and wait for them for the piano lessons to get to be done. And then finally I was like, I want to do that too. So then at 6, I started playing it. And then they probably lasted another year, but I kept on going because I guess I kind of started getting better than them. I don't know. And they're still artistic, but they went more to the visual side of arts, even though they're still huge music fans and still play at home. But they professionally went into the visual side of arts, and I stuck with the music side of arts. And you know, my family was always supportive of anything I played, any shows I did. They always encouraged me and went to shows and. You know, I was supposed to go to music school and never went because I was too busy on the road. I was accepted to Berklee College of Music as a kid, but the band I was in just started growing. And I said, well, I'll put it off for a year and then another year turn into 2 years, another year turn into 3 years. And then a couple of years after that, I signed a record deal and that's my education. But yeah, there was always music in our house and I had a very encouraging family that supported me.
Did your mom or somebody go to Russia with you? That's a pretty major deal for a young kid.
No family went. It was actually kind of like an exchange thing where the people from where I was studying went to Russia and we joined in, like kind of joined with the schools there as a kids. So we would kind of you know, end up playing together, studying together. It was pretty cool, but it was a very artsy trip, if I remember correctly. You know, I think I was 14, yeah. And there was just, you know, we did a production of Godspell while we were there, and we did we would play with orchestras while we were there. I would sit there and watch their 4-year-old prodigies just blow my mind playing playing, you know, stuff that they shouldn't even be playing with their tiny fingers. So it was really, really cool. But it was just definitely very artsy, if I remember correctly, which was awesome to me. I mean, and what was cool back then was, you know, I was like in eighth grade or something like that. And, I was dealing with the Russian eighth graders, maybe mostly a lot of times. And back then, English was not a requirement for them to speak. And we weren't, you know, I was not studying Russian. So a lot of them were in the same kind of class. You know how when you're in middle school, you have to take a language class. Like people get forced to, you know, you have to take Spanish one or French one, or German one. So I was like in French one or two or something. And the people that were in those in those classes in Russia would find the other kids that would and we would speak horrible French to each other, or the people that were in German one would speak horrible German to each other so they could speak together.
That's funny, man.
It was really a educational experience for me, just because I was, you know, I was never away from home by myself like that it taught me that music really could bring people together.
Yeah.
It was really, really cool.
Well, especially back then, it was still the, you know, kind of like the Iron Curtain. It wasn't, you know, it hadn't really fallen or anything like that. So that's pretty interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. And one of the quick things that happened was, one of the guys had a guitar. I picked up his guitar and started playing Beatles songs. And then 20 people gathered and sang Beatles songs together in English. It was,
that is really cool.
It was one of a very quick, bonding moment for me and a couple of the musicians there, which I wish I remember their names or knew who they are. I have no clue who they are anymore.
That's wild.
It was really cool.
Yeah. It's funny. I interviewed a metal player from Russia last week, and his English, first of all, his written English was no joke better than most people that are raised here. I mean, his written English was like really, really like proper English, and I couldn't believe how well he spoke. I was blown away. So, I mean, you know, they're definitely teaching it now.
It's definitely different. You know, I did before I moved to LA, I did a little thing with some people in Warsaw, Poland.
Yeah.
I would play at a hotel bar. I somehow got recommended. Oh, my friends from LA recommended me. And I went to Warsaw thinking it's going to be like going to Russia when I was 14, you know, hygiene and things are going to be different. I go there and it's nothing but, you know, English speaking club night people. It was really, really an eye opener as to where Europe is now.
That's cool, man.
Yeah. Yeah. It was really, really cool.
Are your brothers, your siblings, your family still back in Pittsburgh?
My parents and my little sister are in Pittsburgh. I have my oldest brother is in Beckley, West Virginia. And then my second brother lives in Hong Kong.
Oh, wow. That's wild. Very cool, man. Well, thank you for sharing all that. That's nice, man.
We are an international family.
You guys are, man. I'm just like, you're global here, man. You started acting also as a kid. And what was the hook? Because I could see that being really compelling. Yet you gravitated back to music, seems like, pretty quickly.
Yeah. You know, I was such a young kid. You know, I think my mom got me and my brother involved with that thing with The King and I. It was just like, I guess she heard somewhere that they were looking for, you know, 6 to 10-year-old kids to be in a production with The King and I. And she, I don't even remember. I remember the audition, but I don't remember, like, you know, even being asked to go there. I just remember being there. There was a place called the Syria Mosque in Pittsburgh, a legendary place. It's not there anymore, but, they had the auditions in the basement, and there was they separated three groups of kids. Maybe I think there might've been 5 kids in a group or maybe 6 kids in a group. And they made us all sing Happy Birthday. And I guess ours was in the best key, you know, in tune.
That's wild.
And they picked our little group, and it was a fun little thing. I never really considered it acting, I guess. I was it was more uh you know, eventually it turned into knowing how to stand on stage and singing and projecting, learning how to sing as a kid. But yeah, I didn't do much acting after that. I definitely gravitated towards the musical side of things. I've done did a few musicals in school and stuff like that, but still was more into the instrumental side of stuff. I focused more on concert band and choir and stuff like that as a kid.
What do you think that was? Like, did you just say, "Hey, I like this more. It's cooler." Like, what was your?
I wouldn't say it's cooler, I think it's just something that I felt connected with. I never really felt connected with memorizing like lines and trying to be dramatic or try to pull out my nose hairs to cry or something like that. You know, I was more.
Is that what they do? That's kind of funny.
I think that was a skit from Steve Martin or something like that.
Oh, that's funny.
But I think when I started playing piano, I realized that I could play stuff by listening to it, but I could also read. So it was also things came pretty easy that way. And then especially after I started playing saxophone, I was able to play by ear a little bit. And then when I got a guitar is whenever things really connected with me musically. And you know, I actually felt more that I could express myself. I learned how to write music and almost write down feelings and stuff like that. So it started becoming more of my identity to pick up an instrument and learn how to play it. And that's where I felt, you know, I felt drawn to that.
Yeah. Do you like today as an adult, is it easier for you to express yourself through an instrument, or are you able to sit down and like, you know, with a friend or your wife or something like that, like say, "Hey, here's how I'm feeling about stuff"?
Oh, I'm not good with that at all.
Really? Okay. So the instrument.
I'm definitely more of I'll let it out on stage more. In front of you know, people I don't know more than, you know, I mean, every once in a while, I mean, there's serious conversations here and there, but I'm definitely not much of a talker when it comes to my feelings. I'll definitely write down stuff more than
interesting. I think that's common with a lot of musicians I've spoken with.
Yeah, it might be a musician thing, might be a Libra thing. I don't know.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
I interviewed a guy named John Jorgensen. I don't know if you know John. About a year and a half ago, probably, and he played at Disney. He's a gypsy jazz, just a great guitar player out in LA, I think. But and he said that was the greatest tuition that he ever had, because the same thing as you, he's playing six shows a day. He's playing all, you know, you got to put on a costume and do some ragtime jazz, and you got to put on do some rock. And so I was curious, was that the same experience for you as far as tuition? Like, man, this really cut your chops.
Absolutely. So, because I never went to college, but I got recommended. If we're talking about my gig at Kennywood Park, which is still there in Pittsburgh, it's owned by different people now. But I never went to school, but in the middle of high school, somebody I looked up to a lot, he went to Berklee College of Music way before I did, and he said, "I'll be home over the summer. You should apply to perform at the park with me." And his name is Scott Riebling. Scott, if you're out there, hi. He's in Boston now. He became a pretty big producer, and he toured a lot with a bunch of big bands back in the late 90s and early 2000s. Anyways, he recommended me because he knew I played piano and he knew I played guitar and I could sing. And I guess he knew I could dance a little bit. Which I don't consider myself a dancer at all, by the way. Anyway, but he goes, "By the way, if you want the gig, tell them you can play banjo." And I never touched a banjo. I never touched a banjo in my life, right? So I wrote it down that I play banjo and guitar and sing and dance and play keyboards. And I even had to play drums on a few songs for a couple of shows in my first couple of years. And next thing I know, I have the job. So And they're like, okay, here's the banjo. And it was a 4-string tenor banjo for Dixie strings. And so I just said, yeah, sure, I know how to play it. He's like, go ahead, just take it home, practice whatever. So I tuned it like the top 4 strings of a guitar. just so I can, you know, play the D triad or that diminished 7 shape or, you know, 7th chords. And I learned pretty quickly to adapt and then how to strum the Dixie style stuff. And and you know, a month later I'm on stage playing wearing a freaking bow tie and a barbershop hat.
Yeah, yeah.
Playing freaking banjo for a show, and the next show is I'm playing my first guitar, which was a 86 Squire Strat through my little practice amp that I kept there on stage. Was a Fender Sidekick 35, and just played 2 rock shows, and then we had to do a singing and dancing show. Yeah, it definitely taught me a lot about performing, taught me a lot about stamina, taught me a lot about how to work with people. Cause you're stuck with people, you know, 8 hours a day in the heat. And then also dealing with song and dance people are different than the band people.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you're dealing with the theatrical type as well. So
this is really good tuition for you in not only musically, but like your music, social behavior kind of.
Well, that to me is the most important thing. You know, what was really cool, you know, and I'm thinking back in hindsight, I think that's how people get recommended to gigs, because if you adapt and you are, which I guess is why that my friend Scott recommended me, because he knew I could adapt. And then I guess he knew that I could do the gig, but also get not show up and be an asshole.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then, and the same thing goes for a lot of the gigs I get. I think, you know, luckily I haven't had to really lift up a phone or do like auditions recently, because, you know, I think it's because of those skills I acquired, you know, working with older people that I respect. And a lot of the bands I work with, I there's a lot of respect for me involved, because I grew up listening to them.
Sure.
And so for that, it all comes together, because I that guy was 3 years older than me, and I really looked up to him as a musician, because he first showed me how to use a 4-track recorder, and I never played a bass until I played his and stuff like that. So I respected him, and then when I started working that you know, 6 days a week playing 6 shows a day with everybody else were college level or graduates. And so the music director for that was a brilliant piano player, and I would try to absorb everything I could learn from him, and I think they saw that, and you know, and it all comes full, you know, it all comes back, you know, back and forth, so that what I learned from them, and they are gracious enough to learn, you know, teach me. It moves on to the next job I have, where I could teach it to somebody else, or I absorb it from the other artist I'm working with, or whatever, you know. So
a few questions on that. First is, you have been doing this, you know, you said it comes full circle, and then the more you work, now you've had, because you've had so many touches across the musical spectrum, not just in different genres and settings, but with actual, the numbers of people that have been exposed to you is huge. You have like sort of like a pretty good network there of people that when, oh, I need this, you know, you may have where somebody has 3 people thinking of them, you may have, you know, 50 or 75. So,
oh, I don't know.
Which is great. Well, yeah, you do, obviously, because, you know, you keep, you know, you're deep in the streets, Walter. I mean, come on, you know?
I still feel like the new guy, so
man, because that's the kind of people that people like to work with, man. You know, the guy that is, you know, the big cheese, but like doesn't pretend that he's, you know, he still feels like he's a new kid learning, you know. And I think that's like, it's about not being an asshole. It's the opposite end of that, you know. People like gravitate to that. Who doesn't want to be around that? You know, that's the thing you want to nurture, you know, the relationship you want to nurture and give to that. But, and that's kudos to you because as you obviously are super adaptable. How did you get like that? Like, were you, like, was that just your natural character you always liked? And also your work ethic, where did that come from?
Well, okay. Work ethic, I don't know. I was never really a hard worker in school or anything like that. I think I just really, really dove into playing instruments. And like I would, you know, when it came to sports and stuff like that, I would work hard. You know, I was a tennis player as a kid and I was a lacrosse player as a kid. So I would work on that stuff and make sure that I had the movements and the techniques that I like to use correctly. So that translated to a piano with me or a guitar with me. Mm. You know, I never liked playing scales and I never understood why I needed to do scales on piano until I bought a guitar or the saxophone. I mean, I understood why, but it never really clicked with me until I started playing guitar.
Yeah.
And so every night I would do what I have to do, but then I would stay up till 2 a.m. as a kid and be in my parents' basement playing guitar, whether it's practicing something out of a book or just listening to something and learning it, like like memorizing the whole Rush catalog or stuff like that. It wasn't work for me. That was my fun.
So you're extremely passion driven.
Yeah, I was very passionate about that, and plus, you know. I started getting jobs, you know, getting hired to sing, you know, besides the park, besides Kennywood Park, my first jobs were playing at churches. And, you know, when I realized I could play and make money, doing it, I realized that that's just kind of what I want to do for a living.
Yeah.
And then especially after when I was 19, I broke my thumb as a skateboarder, as a kid, I used to skateboard a lot. But then on my left hand, I fell and did something called a Bennett's fracture where my thumb just came out and shattered. And I know you can't see anything, but there's a pin. There was a pin stuck in my thumb. So after that, I realized, well, I better take this seriously because A, I'm not going to college and music is what I want to do for a living. So I better buckle down and make sure I do the best I can and at everything I do. So I really committed myself to being a full-time musician at that point. I mean, I was working at like a Levi's store at the time because I didn't go to college. And I was just selling jeans and they wanted me to go to corporate at 19, 20 years old. I was like, no way, I got a gig. And so
good for you.
And yeah, so I stuck with that and I really committed myself to making sure that I always learn. So, whether it was churches, like I said, I ended up playing one of the biggest churches in Pittsburgh, which taught me, you know, I learned how to sequence. I learned how to make tracks there. I learned how to play with tracks. I learned how to, that's the first place I used in-ears and learned how to use a, an in-ear system and what are those called? When you can mix yourself and then I ended up becoming the song leader for and I'm there in front of 4,000 people every day because it was one of those mega churches. And it taught me a lot, and the musicians there are some of the best musicians I've ever played with.
Some great church players, man.
Yeah, yeah. And so they know more about gear and music than anybody. So I learned a lot, absorbing from those players. And it was, and those players were playing on Friday and Thursday, Friday, Saturday nights too, at the local bars, So it taught me a lot of how, well, I could do that too while I'm writing my songs and playing at the bars or stuff like that. So,
yeah. So you just learned that there's a lot of different ways to make a living. And then you just kind of sounds like you really took everything in.
I still am, I mean, like I said, I moved to California in 2011 and I still feel like I'm learning, how to do stuff and, when it comes to communication, when it comes to networking when it comes to, you know, what gear I'm using in my studio and stuff like that. It's, and especially coming out here, there's so many world-class musicians and producers and songwriters that it's inspiring. And it's not like I'm competitive or anything like that. I'm not competitive, but it's like, man, I want to do that. So how do I do that?
Right. So right.
I just kind of learn from that, you know?
Were your folks okay that you weren't going to college? Cause you've mentioned that several times. And, you know, I know, like I grew up in New York City and there's like tons of, you know, people from the Philippines, you know, yeah. Asians from, you know, education is extremely, it's like not, I don't know if it's mandatory, but it's expected. And, you know, most people go.
No, I think, like I said, my parents were supportive. And luckily they understood.
That's great.
I think the first year when I said I wasn't going to go, you know, there was some issues at the time. And I didn't know what direction I was going to go in. At the
sure.
time. And,
like every kid.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like every kid, nobody knows what's going on. Yeah.
Yeah. So basically, you know, and, but they were supportive and they understood why I was doing what I was doing. They might not have supported, you know, I was focusing on with my original band at the time, the band Seventh House.
Yeah.
And, you know, and they weren't a huge fan of the music and the partying and the, and you know, my parents are very strict, born again Christians and,
you know, yeah, that's really cool that they were still supportive of you. That's
and they were doctors, so it's like you would think that they wanted me to go to med school. And you know, at the time when I broke my wrist my first time, I thought I was going to go to med school.
Yeah,
but they knew. I think they saw that I wouldn't do anything else but play music. So they understood that, and you know, and like I said, my dad was a great singer and my mom was a great piano player. So it's like, they might've been, I don't know what their mindset is, but they might've been frustrated musicians as well.
Yeah. I hear that a lot often, to be honest.
You know, I love them and thank them for being patient with me throughout, my childhood with that. Cause Lord knows that I would make a lot of noise. in that house.
Well, you're about to pay it forward pretty soon, so you'll be okay.
Oh man, see, that's the thing. I'm pushing my kid to be a doctor. So
no, you can't do that, man. I know we talked beforehand. You said you don't, or maybe during the interview, you said you don't consider yourself a hustler, but you really are. And I am turned on by that. I really admire and respect that in people. And because I think, the work ethic speaks volumes about the rest of a person's character. You know, usually people have great work ethics. They're honest. They're reliable. Their word is pretty consistent, you know, they're not flaky. It's all the traits that you want in a human being, right?
Go ahead, man. There is one thing that I missed one show in my life, and it was after I moved out here, and I totally flaked out on a show. And it was a solo show, just me playing my acoustic guitar somewhere. And I remember, I still feel guilty to this day.
Yeah,
that happened. I felt horrible that day. I was on the other side of town. Whenever I got the phone call, hey man, where are you? I'm like, oh no, that was today. You know, I got so upset, and you know, at LA traffic. By the time I would have tried getting there, I would have been 2 hours late, anyways. And you know, I just couldn't live my. I'm still so guilty about that, because I'm usually so good about my calendar. You know, I'm not managed by anybody. I will say I'm not very good at my administrative skills. But like when it comes to responding to phone calls or emails or stuff like that. But I once I book stuff, I'm usually good at putting stuff in my calendar and reviewing it earlier in the week. And I just screwed up one day, and this might have been 5 years ago, 6 years ago. And I still feel horrible that happened. Like I can't I'm not forgiving myself for,
well, dude,
for doing that.
You are forgiven. So, yeah. Well, you know what, though? You got to look at it like this. Statistically, if you think of the number of gigs that you've had, it's almost impossible for it not to happen.
Well,
that's, you know what I'm saying? Like, if you're looking at somebody else and saying, man, the guy's probably had 2,000 gigs in the last 4 years or 3 years alone. So it's just like a numbers game. It's going to happen at some point in time. So,
yeah,
you know,
I hope it never happens again.
No, I'm sure it won't, man. But you're the quintessential side man. And I was wondering if you could maybe give some advice to other players out there that are, that don't have a bunch of stuff going on or that want to get more, you know, more business going on in their life, more opportunities. What would you suggest to them?
Oh wow. Don't take my gig. Oh, okay. no, I think, you know, the first thing is, again, be adaptable. You know, my friend Pete Thorne, just did a video on this, about being the hired hand. You know, the first thing he said was, don't be an asshole. Yeah. You know what I mean? And you know, you could be a great player and you could be, you know, God's gift to women or anything like that. But if you're an asshole, you're not going to get hired again.
Yeah.
You most likely won't, you know. So, my advice is, you know, stay humble, be understanding. 'Cause a lot of times you're working with a lot, you know, if you get hired with some of the bands that have been successful whenever, you know, 30 years ago, they were probably 25-year-old kids and know nothing else besides success. And, you know, and they still think that they're in that 25-year-old body, but they're like 60 years old now. You know, you have to be patient with them because they came from a different school as you. Hmm. You know, for me, I feel like I'm a working musician. I have to work and play shit gigs just to make sure I get by to the next gig.
Yeah.
Whereas some of the artists that you get hired for, if you get to a certain level, they were in the studio and getting publishing deals and stuff when they were 25 years old, and so they never had to do the shit gigs.
Yeah.
Or, you know, and if they did, they were bar gigs playing their own music.
Right.
You know, or occasionally a cover gig here and there, and you know, I think you just kind of don't be too humble to keep your mouth shut and learn from these guys sometimes. That's good advice. Another piece of advice, if you want to work, is understand other people's instruments. You know, I think that's kind of why I gravitate towards trying to become a MD for things, because I like making sure I know the bass part's correct, or you know, the third harmony is doesn't move at a certain section. You know, it's one of those things that I gravitate towards. I like, but I think that's also why you'll get the call, especially you know, if you're not a singer, learn how to sing.
Yeah, man.
Learn how to harmonize, even more importantly, so that you could, you know, if you get hired for a singer, you'll get the call because you could play the part, but also support and be harmony. I think that's, you know, I'm still learning. I'm still trying to figure out, you know, how to get the calls, you know? So, you know, but that's, you know, that's my advice. I think just work, play your parts. Don't try to overshadow anybody unless you're asked to. If you're getting hired, you know, if you're in your own band, then do your thing. But you know what I mean?
Totally. I just had a call earlier this morning with, I think I mentioned this, Steph Burns. And I said to him, what was one of the most important lessons? You know, he goes, well, what are the things that accounts for your success? And almost verbatim, he said the same thing. He goes, man, I stay in my own lane. I know my place. I'm not, you know, I might think that I'm here in front of 30, and he plays some massive, massive gigs. And he goes, I know these 70,000 people, they really aren't here to see me, you know, and I'm very, yeah, he said, I'm very cognizant of that. And, you know, you really need to be aware of that. And you said one thing that I think is really good. I just wanted to expand it. You said, basically you said, you know, when looking at other people, you said, put yourself in their shoes without saying those words, you know, put yourself in their shoes. The other thing that allows you to do is it allows you to be empathetic and much more understanding instead of like maybe frustrated or, yeah, which is like a huge, like I'm older, man. Everything I, almost every decision I make is based on what's the path of least stress. And it's so much easier to be empathetic because there's just no stress now because you just, you know, you're compassionate, you're understanding, you know, it's like easier than being frustrated.
I mean, I know, but that as musicians or artists, that's hard to do because, I mean, it's one thing if you're, if you accept yourself as a working musician, then you know that stuff. But, you know, and for me, I didn't start becoming like the side guy until later on. I've always wanted to do the original thing,
right?
And write songs. And that, you know, when I started being a frontman for my own band, stuff like that, you know, and that's where the artistic side of stuff was. And you know, a lot of people that know me know that I can get really moody, or that I could get frustrated, because, you know, in reality, would I rather be on stage singing my songs in front of people than getting paid to play other people's songs? Yes, I would.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the truth. You know, if I could play guitar or piano and spend a night singing my stuff and people would come to that, that would be ideal.
Sure.
But that, you know, I've come to terms that, you know, I would have to go a different route for that. And as I get older and I know my talents are, you know, I have the ability to play other people's music, you know, pretty well and learn it. So, you know, I've come to accept that and, you know, I'll have weeks where I'm frustrated because, you know, man, I used to do this. I used to do that. I used to, you know, I've done this, you know, with my own stuff. And, but now I have to write, you know, sounded like TV trailers, you know, right now, instead of sitting there and pour my heart and soul out of my own music.
Sure.
So you know, as artists and musicians, but a lot of times you are moody. A lot of times you are, you know, you get frustrated or, and it's hard not to because you, all you want to do is express yourself.
Yeah.
But then, you know, if you are have accepted the fact that you are a working musician or the hired hand, you know, you have to separate yourself from that. And like you said, you learn to stay in your lane or learn what your part is. You know, I didn't mind, you know, with the one band I toured with playing keys, I didn't mind, you know, being set up on side and making sure it sounds good. I never needed the attention. You know, it was my job to do that stuff. And luckily, you know, they kept me for 7 years and I had a lot of fun playing, you know, it's a fun job. So.
And I think what you said is really important. And I've had this conversation literally many dozens of times with other people. It comes a point in time, you have to sit and say, hey, I wanted to do this. That's not how it worked out. I'm still grateful. I get to play music every day in a different role. And you got to accept that role.
Absolutely. Yeah. I live in LA. I never thought I would do that. I go outside and it's sunshine every day, especially I grew up in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, man.
and I know you're in Florida and I'm not a big fan of humidity. So,
oh, it's brutal here, man.
Yeah,
brutal.
You know, and so I would, you know, I'd come down and play Epcot and Disney, you know, a couple times a year, with the, Eye of the Tiger band I used to play with.
Yeah.
And you know, it was brutal.
Yeah,
brutal.
It's hot. Terrible, man.
You know, but you know, why not? Why shouldn't I be grateful? I make a living playing music. I have so many great friends that play music too. And you know, a lot of times I don't get to see them. A lot of times I get to listen to them. I listen to them more on your podcast, stuff like that, because they're out, you know, you had my friend Mike Keneal, you had my friend Steve Feketty on recently. Actually, I got recommended because of my friend Quist.
Yeah, I want to say give a shout out to Quist and Corey Congelio for both of those
Corey,
guys. Yeah,
Corey and I grew up together in Pittsburgh.
That's right.
Yeah. So you know what? Like I said, why not be grateful for you know, and the reason why I moved to LA. You know, I went through a divorce in Pittsburgh, and I was definitely in my own weird mood at that time. I had no direction. My band was ended, so I felt like I had two divorces because of my the marriage was over, the band was done. I was sitting playing a solo acoustic gigs and getting drunk every night, and I was like, I need something different in my life. So I decided, I got hired to play with an indie artist, and we were opening up, and we went on the road opening up for Candlebox for a year and stuff like that. And so it opened my eyes to come out to California, and I had no plan. You know, I was just going to play acoustic guitar on the beach and maybe wash dishes at night or something like that, you know? And luckily a month and a half later, I got the call from Survivor, and that stint was really good. So, you know, I think, like you said, why not be grateful for where I am? I get to talk to people like you, and then every other night I go hang out with some of the best players I've ever played with in my life. And it's random. I do the thing at Whiskey every Tuesday.
Which it sounds really cool. My God, that's got to be a ton of fun. Is that Steve? Oh. Steve is on that gig with you, no?
Who's that?
Feketty.
Feketty? No. He does the other one.
The Troubadour?
He does the one at the bowling alley at the Lucky Strike. But
okay.
But we all intermingle, and we're all friends. And Mitch Perry and Chuck Wright from Quiet Riot is the guy that started the one at the Whiskey, and I've been, you know, the house band guy there for the past 3 years, and it's been awesome. And I find myself on stage playing with, you know, I sang and played, you know, Ty Tabor's part from King's X with Doug Pinnock, and
that's cool.
You know, and that's like, you know, I find myself on stage with people that I'd never thought I would ever be on stage with. And, you know, which is really cool. But then, you know, another thing, if I'm not doing that on Tuesdays, you go down to a place called the Kibitz Room. And it's a random just kind of jam. And all these guys are all professional touring guys that sit there too. And you'll have some of the best players in the world just sitting there playing random stuff. And it's incredible.
Yeah. And you're in that scene, which is really cool, man.
Well, there's different scenes, you know. There's the young scene, which happens. And then there's all the older, you know, people that have been around that, you know, that I don't know. LA's so diverse, you know, because there's the hipster scene that's happening, and I'm not really involved with that, but I'd like to, you know, playing with Eagles of Death Metal helped me a little bit because it's a little bit younger of a crowd than what I've been around. But you know, I think you just have to get yourself out there and enjoy yourself.
I think that is critical. You know, you want to do things sincere. You mentioned some of the things you've been doing. What would you say the top three experiences you had musically for any reason? It could be just a good hang, you know, you're on at that particular time.
Ooh. Musically, one of the coolest things that I remember was it with my band Strangeway. We went to the Cavern Club in Liverpool, which is
where the Beatles got started, right?
Yeah, there's a little band called the Beatles.
Yeah,
they got started there, and somehow our original music went there. And one of the coolest moments was, you know, the crowd there had no clue who we were, and when I realized, and you know, and my band, that band was not very successful, but it was my baby. And whenever you have your baby doing something, and then, you know, I wrote a song called Doing Fine Without You, just a catchy little cheesy song. And, but you know, and it's one of those songs that you can go to a crowd, hey guys, you hold out the mic and have them sing along.
Okay.
And it was, you know, I've never really did that. But to have this room full of English people who, and whoever else, Scottish people that were there or whatever, and just quickly teaching them a chorus of a song and then stopping, you know, the drums keep on playing, but you just keep, but you hold out the mic, and they're singing your song. That to me was probably one of the coolest moments ever.
Cause plus it's your song.
It's my song. Yeah. People never heard it before, and quickly adapted to it. And I'm at the Cavern Club.
Yeah.
where the Beatles started. So that to me was probably one of the coolest things musically that happened to me. Let's see. I think every time I get a gig or get a call for an opportunity for a gig, like, you know, that to me is always a big milestone in my, you know, highlight of my musical career, because I would have never thought of being in the certain bands that I've played with. You know, I never thought I would be in Survivor. I never thought I would tour the Band on the Run record with Denny Lane from the Band on the Run record. You know, I would never.
That's incredible.
Yeah, and I'm singing, and I sang a lot of the McCartney songs, and you know, I never thought that would happen, or I never thought that I would play bass with Jack Russell for a couple gigs, or you know, I never thought that, and so those are like definitely highlight memories for me because you know, I would have never met certain people because of that. I never would have. You know, a lot of that stuff turns into other relationships and other gigs. So that's probably number two. And I guess number three, man, I think, I don't know. There's so many, you know, I have so many memorable live performances.
Yeah.
You know, I think one of the big ones for me was my first band, Seventh House. It was a Saturday, and I got a phone call from somebody that wanted to manage us. He was in Pittsburgh. He was the big promoter that brought in all the bands back in Pittsburgh back in the day. I mean, he brought Zeppelin and stuff like that. So he wanted to manage the band that I was in.
Oh, and then put you in the front slot for these acts.
Well, sometimes, but. So he ended up calling me one day. He ended up not managing us, but if it was up to me, he would have been anyway. That's a different story. He called us one day, and we were scheduled to play another little club that night called Graffiti, that's not there anymore either. Wow, nothing's there
anymore. I know. it's like almost a different – it's like looking back 100 years, not like 20, you know?
Yeah. So we were scheduled to play this little club called Graffiti, opening up for, there was a great regional band called Over the Rhine back in from Ohio that we were opening up for. And, but he called that morning saying, hey, what are you doing tonight? I'm like, well, we have a gig later. What's going on? He goes, do you want to play the Civic Arena? Which is like the big arena in Pittsburgh, which again is not there anymore. But, that's where, you know, the Beatles and Grateful Dead and, you know, and Zeppelin, all the bands played there. I'm like, what's going on? He goes, well, John Hyatt's wife was in a car accident, and he was supposed to open up for Bob Seger, so he can't do it. Do you want to open up for Bob Seger? I'm like, yeah. I'll pay you $750. Yes, we'll jump at it. And then from there, we can open up for Bob Seger, and then we can run up the street and play our other show that we had going on. It was one of the most crazy nights ever, because I've never played in front of that many people with a band. So we show up, and my band was a trio at the time. That band was a trio. And we get to the stage, and first time union people were actually helping us carry stuff in. All I had was a Mesa Booga combo that I would go put through a Marsha 412. You know, nothing in road cases or anything. I had two guitars and a crappy little pedal board I built, and that was my rig. So we set up. And he's that monitor guy's like, okay, what do you guys want in your monitors? I'm like, you know, I'm used to playing dive, you know, a little bar. So I'm like, just put my vocals in the monitor, maybe a little bit of the lead singer's vocals. I'm good. And so, and they were laughing, like, really? And, you know, this is, again, learning experience. So during sound check was great, because I stood in one place for the sound check and I could hear my vocals. I could hear my guitar behind me. I could hear what the drummer's doing where I was, and that was great. And then once showtime hit and 18,000 people were here, and you know, it was like, oh my God,
I can't hear anything. And,
you know, I started off, I could hear something, but I took two steps over to my left, and that's where no monitors were. There's no side fills set up. You know, they had them set up, but they were laughing because we didn't ask for anything. So finally they saw me struggling, and I looked over, and I see him just turning up stuff for us to be able to hear ourselves. And it was a very, very, very fun show. Plus we were opening up for Bob Seger.
Yeah.
And there was, you know, it was really, really cool. And, you know, we got to see the first two songs after we were done. And Kenny Aronoff was playing drums with him at the time. And I knew who he was because of all the John Cougar stuff. And you know, it was just one of those cool things. And then we just left there and went straight up to the road and played in front of 150 people.
That's so funny. Did you tell that story? Yeah. Did you tell that story on stage? Like, hey, we just got opened for Bob Seger.
I think we did. Yeah.
Yeah. That would have been cool.
Yeah. That to me was probably a defining, memorable moment.
Yeah.
And the contrast of playing in front of 18,000 people and an hour later playing in front of 150 people doing the same songs.
Right.
So that was really, that might have been in the top three, I guess, if you had that, to answer your question.
That's really cool. Funny enough, Bob Seger's coming here tomorrow night.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I know buddies with Rob, his guitar player, Rob McNally, out of Nashville. So I actually interviewed everybody in his band, I think, except Seger. And so we're gonna grab lunch tomorrow, and then the show's nice, tomorrow man. Night. Yeah, yeah.
This is his last year. His final tour, it says, right?
Yeah. Well, what happened was they were touring last year, and all of a sudden, like, it stopped, and nobody knew why. But he has terrible back problems, I guess, and his back was just really bad, and they didn't know if he'd come back. And you know, I guess he rehabbed it or whatever. 9 months or a year later, here they are. So
that's what I hear.
That's nice, man. Thank you for sharing that. That's really cool. Hey, let's talk. Oh, I want to ask you this: are you I know you said you're not good with admin stuff, but I got to believe you're pretty vigilant with your time because you got so many things going on.
You would think. I mean, I am the procrastinator type.
Yeah.
I definitely have my procrastination moments. I'd rather, you know, I'd rather hop on my motorcycle sometimes instead of learn a song. Or, you know, sometimes it's just easier to be laying on, like, if I have a day off, it's like, man, I'd rather lay on the couch. But then I think, oh crap, I have this show coming up in 2 weeks. I need to make sure I know what's going on, or I need to make sure I have the sounds programmed, or I need to know where I'm playing stuff on the neck. Or so yes, I take pride in making sure I find time to do my job.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's hard because, like the every Tuesday night gig I do, it's like a lot of times I'll get 5 or 6 songs thrown at me that I've never played before. And it's like, I have to get it done and the sound's programmed, or learn how to sing it, or learn how to, you know, and get that done before Tuesday. Or like it, or for Eagles of Death Metal, for instance, you know, I was out on a gig doing the orchestra gig in Connecticut, and I got a call and they said, we'll call you Sunday and let you know if you have the gig. And this was a Saturday or Friday, I'm sorry. And I never heard from them Sunday, and I get home to LA on Monday morning, and they're like, okay, they call me at noon that day. They're like, okay, you ready? Are you good for the gig still? I'm like, oh man, I thought you guys had found somebody. So the gig was on a Thursday, but we're going to rehearse on Wednesday. So I was like, okay. So I buckled down and learned, you know, an hour and a half's worth of music. And what I love about them, it's all in different tuning. Their whole set's on a completely different tuning on guitar. So I had to relearn how to play guitar and visualize the guitar completely differently and then play the songs that Thursday.
Why are they doing that? For vocal accommodations?
That's just how he writes, I think.
Oh, wow.
And it's hard not to play him. I don't want to play it differently. So yeah. I wanted to learn how to play it right. And because that's what I take my pride
sure.
in, is playing something correctly. And every part and every hit and everything like that, I'll sit and make sure I know what I'm doing before I get to the gig. Hmm. And at times I find myself trying to catch up, and I look at guys like, you know, that are constantly practicing and getting better at their instrument, and I get jealous.
Yeah.
Because I'm a lot of times I would much rather sit and get better at what I'm doing, but I'm working so much that on learning or programming or whatever that I don't get to practice, like, you know.
And you realize they're looking at you jealous of you because you're working so much and they're practicing. So it's just like, no, seriously, it's like, you know, you always want what you can't have, you know.
I guess you're right.
Yeah, believe me, if someone's practicing and they're not working as much, they want to be working.
I don't know. I look at my friend like Jeff Coleman, for instance. He'll sit there and post the videos, and he's like messing around while he's practicing at 2 a.m. And I just like get blown away because he's working all the time. You know what okay. I mean?
Yeah.
But you're right. You're right in a way that I wish, you know.
It's not like you're not practicing because you're, at a bar having a drink. You know, I mean, it's like you're not practicing because you're playing. You know,
that's true. You're right.
Yeah. This is the only place anybody ever tells me I'm right, just so you know. You go to your three kids or your wife, it's like it's never like, oh, you're right. This guy sent me this note. Yes, it was. I was like really flattered. I forgot whose interview. Jim Campolongo. It was one I did a while ago, and I guess he just found it on YouTube. And he goes, "Man, you're a brilliant interviewer." I said, it was really kind of you, but I just ran that by my wife and it was absolutely meaningless. But thank you for the momentary thrill that I got by reading that.
Nice.
Hey man, let's talk about gear for a few minutes. What is your, are you a gear hound? I mean, you got a shit ton of guitars over there. So I'm imagining.
Oh, I have way too many. I mean, it's funny. I just moved and my girlfriend took a picture of the movers because she captioned it, "Are we moving or are we going on tour?"
That's great, man.
Because in the driveway there was my Rhodes, there was my Yamaha piano, there was 45 guitar cases.
That's awesome. You know,
20 amps sitting there. So it's like, yeah, I'm kind of a gear nerd. I definitely have a problem.
So tell me, man, what are your top three guitars? Not that you need for sessions, but the ones you like to play the most.
Oh man. What's funny is, okay, my top three guitars. Well, of course I have a 65 Strat, which is kind of like, but I don't play it. So it's not one of, I mean, I'll play it every once in a while in the studio.
Is that the one back there behind you? You showed me the burst.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know the listeners can't. I know listeners can't see it.
No, it's a beautiful burst. Would look like a rosewood neck or maybe an ebony neck. I can't see it. It's beautiful.
That's rosewood, and it has Case Candy, original
Fender booklet.
And look at these strings from the 60s. Some
wow,
strings.
That is, where the hell did you find that with the original strings and everything?
And look at this, the original guitar cable. It's all gray and weird.
That is wild.
So that's one of my babies, and that was found in New York City. Actually, I shouldn't tell the story because
whereabouts? Yeah, man, spill the beans.
Oh shoot, I might get arrested for thievery.
No, we're protected here on this show.
Okay, I need to talk about this a little bit because this has a lot to do with where I am today. So, this was end of 98, probably about 99. I was in between things and I didn't know what I was doing. And again, as growing up, so I walked into a brand new guitar store in Pittsburgh, or actually a suburb of Pittsburgh. And I just randomly walked in because I knew all the other guitar stores. And I'm like, what is this place? I saw it, turned around and walked in. And, noticed this guy had a couple cool collectible guitars on the wall. Anyways, a week later, I'm working at the place. So, and literally the guy goes, I got to go away for a week. You're watching the shop. I'm like, okay. So now I'm managing the shop while he goes to the NAMM show. And, cut to whatever, we become best friends. Like right. He became one of my best friends and a mentor. Like I thought I knew about guitars. But I really didn't. I knew how to play them and I didn't, but I knew what I thought was cool. But, he kind of was a big collector and he would fly all over the country and learn about collecting guitars. And he was actually known as, the Rick guy. A lot of people who had questions about Rickenbackers would go to him. We ended up going to a lot of the big guitar shows, collectible shows and, you know, Philadelphia and North Carolina, stuff like that. And, I learned a lot about guitars and vintage guitars. So, and his name is Mark Hoover. He since passed. I'm stoned out over it, but
sorry, man.
It's all good. He was one of my best friends and a very, very big, very, I considered him a mentor, to me in life and stuff like that. Anyway, and I actually have one of his motorcycles. He spent the last 2 years of his life rebuilding a motorcycle. And, his brother said, he always talked about riding with you in California. We're going to send the bike out to you. Wow. Anyways. That winter, it was a weird the winter of 99, was a very weird time for me guitar wise. I randomly won this Gibson SG one of those departments, not Nordstrom, but Macy's.
That's weird.
I entered my name into one of, you know, just randomly, you know, you walk past and you enter your name and, I'm like, cool, I can use an SG. I didn't have an SG. So I won that. And then that was in the same month. And this is right when I was learning about vintage gear. And I was like, okay, I really want to find a deluxe, like a 60s deluxe reverb amp. So we go to this Columbus guitar show, me and my friend Mark. And, this guy that walked in, he didn't know what he had. And I got a 64 deluxe reverb for $600 back in the day. And it was awesome. And then randomly back then I was still playing New York City a lot and I would drive up from Pittsburgh and play every Monday at CBGB's and with my first band. And my brother who lived in New York City at the time, he goes, hey man, I love my brother Wendell. He would invite all his friends and everybody out to my gigs. And he was the guy out there in the crowd screaming my name. I can't thank him enough. But one day he goes, hey man, I invited my boss out. And my boss was telling me, hey man, I hear your brother plays guitar. I used to play guitar. And, you know, if your brother would be interested in a Strat, I think I have a 70 Strat laying under my parents' bed. So this is my brother's boss in New York. I hope he doesn't hear this. So my brother calls me and says, hey, my boss wants to know if you're interested in a 70s Strat. And back then I was looking for the big headstock because that's the one I thought I could afford at the time. Cause I never thought I could afford one of those. And, I say, yeah, sure. Tell him to bring it to work, take pictures of it and send it to me. So I'm at the guitar store with my friend Mark, and my brother sends me pictures of this guitar. And the first thing I say, send me the serial number, then send me pictures. So the first thing that he sends me is the serial number, and it starts with an L. And Mark, my friend Mark, immediately goes, you know what this is? And without even looking at the rest of the guitar. And I'm like, no, what's up? He's like, what's up? He goes, it's an L series. And I'm like, what does that mean? He goes, they only made L series from 64 to 66. That guitar is from 64 to 66.
Wow.
So I said, he said, buy it, offer him. What do you want to offer it? I'm like, I don't know. And so my brother goes, what do you want to offer him? I said, offer him $500. And I shouldn't even be talking about this because it's so bad. And the guy, you know, the guy goes, I don't know, how about eight? And he said, how about 1,000? And I said, I don't know, man. It's got 5 strings on it right now, and the strings are all rusty.
I'm gonna have to put new strings on it
and clean it up. It's like there's some grime on it. I'm like, he's like, okay, how about 8 or something like that? And I just said, I told my brother, dude, give him money right now. I will be up tomorrow and pick up the guitar. So he took it home with him that day. And so I had a great collecting story that year though. I got my 64 Vibraverb that same month, which is another rare amp they only made for 2 years back then with the 15 inch speaker.
You still have that?
But I still have it.
Yeah.
But to answer your question, so my 65 Strat.
Well, hold on a minute. I'll give you $850 for that guitar.
No way. This white Les, this is a 1980 Les Paul.
Oh, that looks great, man. Is that heavy as hell?
It's heavy as hell. Yeah. But that's my baby. That's what I normally play for my own shows. It's a 1980. It's beautifully yellowed and reliced, and I love it. And I love the way it plays. I got rid of all my standards because I think I grew up so much playing. Well, my first Les Paul was my black, which I still have it. It's signed by Les Paul. It's in a case right now, but it's my black 78. Custom, but I fell in love with the ebony fretboard.
Man, I love that. Ebony.
I fell in love with those, and I got so used to it that all the standards I bought I couldn't get used to because they have the rosewood fingerboard, and I just sold them. You know, the only other Les Paul I kept is I have a 94 black like studio, and I keep it because the pickups sound great and it has an ebony fretboard.
Yeah.
And I use that for the crap gigs. So, and then the guitar I'm playing most now, wow, it's hard to say my top three guitars. I love this, I have a 64 J45 that I just sit around and play all the time and it records so amazing. I have this 1981 335 Pro that I play a lot.
That's a
I
black love one. That. Black no, or sunburst? I can't see it.
Yes, yeah, it's sunburst.
Okay, yeah, that's a really pretty guitar.
It's pro. It comes with the little fine tuners and everything on it. It's originally, I just like the way it sounds and the feel of that guitar. The pickups are very dark. I think I tend to like the darker, not so high gain pickups. Because my white Les Paul also has kind of darker sounding pickups, which I really like. But then again, I mean, I play gigs every week, and I've been bringing out this G&L Doheny that they I had the prototype because they wanted to use the new pickups, and they built some humbuckers, and there's a new they put new things on them where you could change it from humbucker to parallel to series. And I've been using that a lot. It's still the prototype. So they just now, put it on the market, and, hopefully G&L guys, hopefully I'll come down and pick up mine, which I was talking to Dave and everyone down there that I want the, gold sparkle.
There you go.
Yeah. So anyway, hopefully I'll get that.
But hey, wait a minute. Who's this? So it shall be written. So it shall be done. That's Yul Brynner, man.
that's the truth. There you go. It all comes full circle.
Yeah, yeah, man. That's so funny.
Yeah. Yeah. But then, you know, I'll find myself playing. I have a cheaper PRS with the CE22 that I can get every sound out of that I need. So I keep that close to the door because that's the first thing I grab when I play my little local gigs because, you know, it could sound good through the certain amps. And I'll usually bring out a Bogner for certain gigs. I have the Alchemist is an underrated amp that they don't make anymore that they've teamed up with Line 6. And it's just a great all-around sounding amp that it's easy to get out there. And sometimes I don't even plug a pedal board through in it because you can get away with not using one. And but in the studio, I use my Bogner Shiva a lot. I use the Vibe Reverb. I use my Vox AC15 a lot for recording.
Is that a UK one or like an old
no,
one?
No, just the cheapy, the Chinese one. It doesn't even have the blue speaker in it. It's just whatever came standard, and it sounds so good. And then another amp I use recording a lot is my 70, I think it's a 77 Vibrachamp. It's a 70s Vibrachamp. I love that amp and miking that up and putting pedals in front of that thing because there's so much clarity that you get out of that amp. But then again, I use Kempers.
Yeah.
For recording a lot too. And
you're so... you have so many uses for things. I mean, like you could use something on a keyboard. I mean, you've really got to know a lot about gear.
I have a lot of nice basses and I have a lot of nice keyboards. But I'm not the most technical guy, like computer literate or at the best at like going to a keyboard and learning what, you know, knowing exactly, I have to learn it, you know?
Sure. Well, those things are not really, it's like going behind a plane and like, you know, oh, let me, you know, what do I, you know, it's like a million buttons there, man. It's not like, you know, three switches.
That's why I like, you know, I still consider myself an analog kid because I'll treat recording like analog in a way where as long as it sounds good going in, it's going to sound good going out. So that's what I like to think.
By the way, tell your girlfriend that, you know, I usually preface every interview on social media with a really cool quote, and yours is going to be prefaced with, are we moving or are we going on tour? That is like fucking right. Awesome, man. That's the winner.
I'll have to send you that picture.
Yeah, send it. I'll use that as your picture for your interview if you want. Man, tell me your top, let's say, 3 or 4 or 5 Desert Island discs.
Oh my gosh. Man, there's way too many. Okay. I guess I missed that question whenever you said stuff. Anyways, top, whatever, 4 or 5. One might have to be Revolver by the Beatles. See, that's unfair. I would say every Beatles record because that would take up the whole list because I'm just a huge, I love the production. I love the songwriting. I love the harmonies. But, you know, I think Revolver. And Abbey Road. Man, I can't decide. For me, man, I think it all depends on the mood I'm in. Exit Stage Left by Rush.
Great record.
Simon and Garfunkel's Greatest Hits.
Man, you know what? I absolutely love Simon and Garfunkel, man. I mean,
I think that's where my diversity comes from because I would play shows as a 15-year-old kid. I'd play like Fly By Night or whatever for one thing, and then I'd go home and sing April Come She Will by Simon Garfunkel and learn how to do the finger picking, and that's where I think, you know, there's so many weird influences I have.
Yeah,
you know, because I grew up listening to the Smiths and the Cure
and Smiths are so cool.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Johnny Marr's guitar playing and the emotional weird lyrics that Morrissey was writing. I loved it. You know, Robert Smith, the same thing. He was great. He wrote some amazing guitar parts. And, you know, and so that it's weird. I have such a weird collection of top music, you know? So yeah, besides the Beatles and Wings and Simon and Garfunkel and Rush, you know, I think is Closer to the Edge is a masterpiece. I think, but then again, I just put on Big Generator record.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yeah. I think that's what it's called, isn't it?
I haven't listened to that record since I went to I saw the tour. I mean, I was a big fan, but I haven't listened to that record recently. And Alan White and Trevor Rabin's work and Chris Squire's work on that record is so incredible.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things like you know, I'm such a nerd that it's so hard for me to pick, you know.
No, that's a tough, that's a ridiculously tough question, especially if you have a lifetime catalog of music in your head that rotates all the time.
Yeah, luckily, you know, I grew up, like I said, you know, Elvis was playing or Tapestry was playing or Rumours was on at my house. And I put on Fleetwood Mac record from beginning to end, you know, and I was so attracted to the sounds that came out of all these records. You know, there was one memorable time in my life. I think I was five. It's before I even played instruments. All my family was going to this park, and I was with, my god family, whatever. So there was this little park, a playground. But then when we got there and we were parking, everyone jumped out of the car except Yellow Submarine was playing on the radio. And I said, I can't go out yet because I need to finish the rest of the song. So luckily my mom sat in the truck with me and let me finish the rest of the song before I can go play, because I wanted to listen to the rest of the song.
Yeah.
Even though Yellow Submarine is not my favorite song, but you know, now, but it's like, I have too many Desert Island records, I think, in different genres. Cause I'll listen to, you know, one of the Opeth records, and I'll listen to it over and over and over and over and over and over again, because I love it so much. But then I'll go in and just listen to Bruce Springsteen's, you know, Nebraska record. And that's all I want to hear for that week, you know?
Yeah.
It's weird.
Very cool. No, man, that's totally normal. I think most people that are into music are the same way, you know, and you have that connection with it, man. It's deep, you know, and you want what you want at that moment.
Yeah, true.
Hey, most important things you've learned about yourself, Walter, through your career experience and life in general?
I learned that I'm a pretty patient person. I think that came with, you know, I discovered that when I was teaching. I taught up to 60 people a week for a while, and
that's a big load.
Yeah, and I learned to be patient, because not every 6-year-old kid is going to understand what you're doing.
Yeah.
Or not every 75-year-old guy who just started playing guitar is going to get it right away. And their hands, you know, a lot of them were construction workers or something like that, and their hands aren't going to be the same. So I learned how to adapt and be patient. I think and luckily I feel, you know, I have the gift for patience.
That's that is a really good gift, man, because it's a lot less pressure to be patient. Oh, it is.
Well, unless I'm driving in traffic, then I'm not. So, that you'll see a completely other side of me. I think that to me is one thing I've learned about myself. I learned a lot of times that I'm not as good as I think I am. I definitely get humbled pretty easily by so many other people who, you know, you know, and I don't mind getting humbled or getting, I don't think I'm good. I don't think, you know, I know I'm never going to be this, you know, I'm not going to be the Joe Satriani of the world or the Steve Vai, or, you know, some people are gifted with that. And I've accepted that I'm not going to do that, or I'm not going to be that guy. Do I want to play like that? Sure. And that's why I've sat and learned some of this stuff, and recently got to play with Joe Satriani's band. I played, you know, Always With Me, Always With You, and they were like, I can't believe you know that. You know, it was just at a party, but they were all hanging out, and I started playing it, messing around, and they went along with it, and I got through with the whole thing, and I think I only messed up one part.
That's
anyway,
really cool, man.
You know, it's one of those things. You know, I don't want to come across as being too humble, but I still feel like the new guy here in LA, and I want to just keep on working.
I also think people that are sort of smart realize how little they know, and people I've seen that, and people that are maybe not so smart tend to be the ones that think they know everything.
Yeah. That's, well,
you know, that's, it's just, that's my observation. Now, if you're a smart person and you have a decent level of awareness, you pretty much know, shit, man, I got a lot further to go in whatever your endeavor or thing you're doing, man, you know?
Absolutely. I think that's common sense. But
okay. Yeah, I think so too. But, you know, something or someone you miss from your childhood.
Well, I told the story about my guitar mentor. He passed away 3 years ago now.
The guy you worked for him in the store.
Yeah, yeah. He became one of my best friends, and you know, not only did we work together, but we hung out. We'd go out at night, or he came when I signed my record deal. First, he came down to the studio. He provided me gear. And then he came up to the mixing studio in New York City with us. And I miss being able to pick up the phone and just call him and say, "Hey, man, this is what's going on." Because, and he was one of my biggest supporters. Because he was. It's hard to find people that actually believe in you.
Yes, it is.
You know, besides your family, and he was one of the only guys that believed in me, and of course he lent me gear. He did this and that. I've never asked for a penny for anybody, but he was one of those guys that would take, you know, give a shirt off his back for not just me, but a lot of people.
Yeah.
And so he was, I'm one of the guys I miss a lot. I miss, man, the singer that was on the road with Survivor, the original singer, Jimmy Jameson. He and I got along great. I miss him. He was, he became a good friend on the road. My grandmother, I miss a lot. She was a great inspiration on the piano. There's a lot of, you know, people that, you know, we're getting to that age where that people are dropping like flies, you know? Yeah. So, yeah, but those are probably some of the big ones I miss right now from, you know, that I learned a lot from.
Thank you, man. And yeah. I'm sorry for all your losses, man.
Oh, we all go through it. And that's how life is.
Flip the switch. Happiest moment or time in your life?
Huh. Well, in my life, I think getting my first guitar. I remember when I got my acceptance letter to Berklee College of Music, I was ecstatic, even though I never went, because mm-hmm. I never thought I would get in. I guess from what I hear, it's going to be in 3 months. When my daughter is born, I'm hearing that. That changes what you think of your happiest time in your life. So I'm looking forward to that and seeing what's going to happen with that. I don't know what else. I think being in certain studios was very happy. Is a very happy time. Being on certain stages, it's a happy time. You know, when I'm on my bike, and I'm in my own helmet, and there's nothing else in my head besides what's going on in front of me. That's where I find a lot of happiness, because that's my only real alone time.
Yeah.
Even if I'm in the studio, I'm surrounded by gear and stuff, but I don't really have this therapy thing. So
yeah,
a lot of times, just being in my own helmet is my own therapy. So yeah.
Biggest. That's it. Biggest business or personal win so far?
So far. Well, I guess, you know, as growing up as a kid, you always want to have a record deal. So the first time I signed a record deal was one of my biggest achievements. The first time I played it in front of over 100,000 people was another big achievement.
God, what was that with? That's...
That was like Sweden Rock Fest, whatever. I think it was something like that. It was like 100,000 people. Which is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Let's see. You know, besides winning certain, gear, like like, you know,
winning your SG. That's pretty freaking cool.
But yeah, but I call winning, you know, when I'm only spending a certain amount of money on cars, that's winning as well.
Yes.
So yeah, there's a lot of those things that happen. Yeah. What else we got?
We got three more questions. Most difficult decision you've ever had to make, or toughest thing you've ever had to do?
It wasn't hard, but it was also hard to leave home. You know.
Yeah.
Pittsburgh is a beautiful city. Pittsburgh, you know, my family is amazing. I was making a good living there, but at the same time, I wasn't fulfilled. So it was. Plus, I was going through really hard stuff in my life, anyways. But
that's the time hard to go sometimes, because it's like you need a restart. I get it.
Oh, I completely made a restart. Yeah. Total restart. I was vegetarian, and then my going away dinner, I had a steak for the first time in 17 years.
You go, man.
I totally changed my life around and wanted to start over completely. So, but that was hard.
Starting over is really hard. No matter what you're doing, it's never easy.
It was hard. I was lonely. It was a complete new place, but I was motivated. So,
did you have any contacts there?
In LA when I moved here, yeah.
Okay.
I had a few.
Good.
And it was crazy. It was a weird time.
Yeah.
You know. I mean, my contacts, I have to give shout outs to them, because if it wasn't for my friend Shane Soloski on bass, I wouldn't know certain people. If it wasn't for him introducing me to Eric Dover, singer extraordinaire, guitar player, I wouldn't know a lot of people. I mean, I found myself playing, you know, within a month or two of living where I was, I found myself playing with Dizzy Reed from Guns N' Roses, because Eric Dover was singing with him, and he said, "Hey man, I need a bass player." So next thing I know, I'm playing bass with this, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
If it wasn't for certain people, I have, you know, so I have to shout out to those guys.
The music community is one of the most gracious communities like that I believe exists. And I'm a guy who's come out of the business world, and I can tell you it's not like that in business. You may get a hookup once in a blue moon, maybe, but in the music community, it seems like if you do a good thing, people get behind that. And that is a very rare, in my opinion, a rare thing.
No, it's completely true. I mean, you know, there are some of the competitive or jealous, however you want to describe them, people. But you know, sometimes they work hard too, and they get what they have to get done. But
sure,
I don't live that way. I am gracious for and thankful for the people that have recommended me or believed in me, and or whatever that could that I'm lucky enough to call friends. So
yeah, cool. You know, I always say you sometimes need someone to get your foot in the door, but keeping that door open is up to you. You know, once you're in, you got to, okay, it's on you now. So you've done a good job of that, because I cannot believe how busy you've been and how many things you got your fingers.
Yeah, you know, my girlfriend always tells me, she goes, "You've been in LA for 8 years, and look what you've done."
Yeah, yeah. Like, she's right, man.
And I, you know, I sometimes I don't get to see it like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, and if that's all I've ever done, if that's all I get to do professionally, then I'm cool with it. I'll keep on playing gigs no matter what. So
very cool, man. Yeah. Anything you regret not doing?
No, I don't think I have any, you know, cause I wouldn't be where I am right now. You know, like a lot of people say, do you regret not going to school? Yeah, part of me says yeah, because I'd be a much better player, and I probably would have met certain people a lot sooner. But what's cool is I would have been I'm playing with some of the people I would have went to school with.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. But I never went. So, but you know, they're in debt, and I got their old books. That's what
and you got the 65 Strat.
Oh, no. So part of me regrets not going to school in a way, because I devoted my life to my band at the time. And I hardly even talk to those guys anymore. So it's like, why did I devote, you know? But then again, it led me to.
Yeah, but you could say that about, like, you know, I got married to somebody and I was with them for X amount of years and we don't even speak. And you go back and say, well, why did I do that? This is the shit that happens, man.
That's the truth, man. I've been through that. So.
So have I. So, I mean, it's.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's what should happen.
So, yeah. A lot of times I feel like I could regret that, but I don't, because I wouldn't be where I am right now with who I am, with the people I'm around. So, yeah.
And last question, Walter, man, and I appreciate your time. You've been really cool and it's really nice talking with you and getting to know you. Biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years, and how much of this change has been intentional and how much is just a natural part of aging?
Wow. I still feel like I'm doing exactly the same thing I've been doing since I was 14 years old. So it's hard for me to see any difference besides the gray hair.
Better gray than bald.
You know, I think it all comes back to the better gray than bald. Sorry.
Trust me.
That's funny. Yeah, I am.
Black. Dude, you got a great head of hair, man.
Thanks, man.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Change in personality. I think moving here has made me more chill. You know, I'm definitely a chill guy. I mean, I know I need to work on not always showing when I'm frustrated on stage or anything like that. I'm trying to realize more now, no matter what, when I'm on stage, no matter what's going on, I'm lucky to be on stage, you know. I need to be, you know, I was in a motorcycle accident once and I thought maybe, you know, man, that could have changed my life forever,
yeah.
You know? So here I am playing at the Whiskey a Go-Go every Tuesday night, which is a world famous place. And I need to make sure I appreciate that. So I think just, you know, my kind of just again, what we talked about, being grateful for what you have and where you are. That's what I'm trying to accept more. I didn't really feel that before I came here. So,
well, it means you're in the right place. That's a good thing.
I feel like I am. This is my village. These are my people.
That's very cool, man.
You know, I get to produce records with some of my friends.
Why don't we talk about that? You
sure.
Just finished a record with Waiting for Monday. Talk about that, man.
Yeah. Oh, I'm really happy about this thing. It's really cool. My friend August Zadra, who listeners might know as a guitar player for Dennis DeYoung, and then my friend Rudy Cardenas. He was on American Idol. Great singer. They signed this record deal on Frontiers Records, the Italian-based label, and they approached me and said, "Hey, you know, would you want to help write some songs and this and that?" So it started off as writing sessions, and I had a bunch of, you know, songs and they were going for a certain style of music. It's very, you know, Frontiers is kind of like an old school label where a lot of classic rock sounding stuff. So my goal was to help them write songs that you think you've heard before. Like,
that's like, interesting. So you're writing in the genre of 80s rock or something like that.
Yes and no, because there are some modern twists to a lot of the songs. But because of where, you know, the people that I've played with and you know, Rudy sings, he was a singer for a Journey tribute band. He's got one of those voices.
Okay.
You know what I mean? And
yeah.
And but so certain things came very organically when we started writing the session, and it turned out pretty quickly that I was going to record the whole record for them.
Hmm.
That wasn't initially the plan, but after a while, after them coming to my studio, you know, me and Rudy wrote a couple of the songs by ourselves. August came in and brought a bunch of his songs. I sat and rearranged a lot of the songs.
I thought August was an East Coast guy.
No, August.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay, because Jimmy's in Jersey. That's why I thought that.
That's how a lot of the bands,
yeah,
like, you know, where they're all in different cities. But so he's out here. He's about 15 minutes south of me now.
Oh, very cool.
So we just worked hard on getting the songs done, and we went to my friend Shane's studio to record drums with Joe Travers on drums. I got him on drums, and he nailed the drums in 2 days, and we took the rest of it to back to my studio. I recorded all the bass and guitars and drums and keyboards. Not drums, sorry. Bass, keyboards, guitars, and vocals in my studio, and I did all the miscellaneous percussion myself. And Andy Zuckerman just mixed all their stuff, and we took it to Howie Weinberg to get mastering last week. And I'm very proud of it. I'm very proud of the way the songs turned out, the way the production turned out. And hopefully we'll find out when it's going to come out. We're doing artwork and everything right now. So hopefully in the next 6 months or so, it'll be released. I don't know exactly. So I'll definitely hit you up.
And yeah, man, come back on. Yeah. We'll talk about it. We'll showcase the record. Yeah.
Great guitar sounds, great vocal harmonies and production. I'm just very, very proud of how it came out. And the fact that, you know, they let me be the main producer on it is really, really cool.
And the name of the band is Waiting for Monday. You don't have a title yet, but we will wait for Monday for the record to come out.
Yeah, they're still building a website and a Facebook page and everything like that, because it was never really built. So they're doing that now.
Awesome. And let me tell people where they could find you on social media. It's Walter Eno, I-N-O, and he's on Instagram and Facebook. You can hit him up, Secret Asian Man Studios. I guess that's better sounding, Secret Pan Pacific Man Studios, right? Secret Asian Man. What's that?
Yeah, Secret Asian Man Studios on Facebook and Instagram. You could also follow my music page on Facebook, which is just Walter Eno Music on Facebook. I think I have too many friends on my personal page now, so I'm strictly on that music page. And secretasianmanstudios.com is also there, but I hardly go to it because more people go to the social media sites anymore.
Yeah, and if you're interested in working with Walter either as a producer or for him to do tracks, remember he plays bass, guitar, and keyboards all really well. Hit him up on Instagram or message him on Facebook or Instagram. Again, it's Secret Asian Man Studios. And that's it, man. Anything else I forget? Anything I missed?
Not really, you know. I think just the other projects. Just if you follow me, you'll see what I'm doing. I have fun playing stuff with people, with a lot of really cool people. So
awesome! Is there a baby gift registry?
There is a baby gift registry on Amazon and Target.
So. There you go. So you can hit them. You can send your love.
I tried having the registry at Sweetwater and Musician's Friend, but she didn't. That didn't
fly. I'm just telling you, man. That's like one of the best quotes I heard. And you got to send me that picture. Are we moving or are we going on tour? That is the best, man. Hey, man, I can't thank you enough for everything. Honestly, really enjoyed talking. Really enjoyed getting to know you.
It was a blast, man.
You know, thanks for being so candid and sharing your story, Walter. And
I appreciate it.
And good luck with the baby, man. I'll speak to you after that and before that. Everybody, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this, share it with a friend on your social media channels. We appreciate your support. Thanks very much to Walter Eno for spending time with us. Again, check him out online, mostly at Instagram and Facebook at Secret Asian Man Studios, or on Facebook at Walter Eno Music. And it's I-N-O is Eno. Make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get on our newsletter list so you and I can connect. And most important, remember that happiness is a choice. So choose wisely. Be nice. Go play your guitar and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.